From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A Duke University professor places Manhattan's Diamond District under the microscope. He explains how that unchanging local economy represents an example of stateless commerce. North Carolina legislators spar over one Democrat's assessment that the state's traditional public schools are failing. You'll learn why he believes this. The new leader of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation explains that group's work to promote business-friendly state policies. And we'll speak with a doctor and libertarian scholar who says most people misdiagnose the ongoing opioid crisis. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Some positive news for Governor Roy Cooper in the latest Elon University poll, which shows the governor gaining the support of nearly half of North Carolina voters. Now, for President Donald Trump, his approval rating up, but still not enough to overcome significant opposition. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's been digging into the Elon poll numbers, and he's here to talk about what he found. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
First of all, Governor Cooper, he should be pretty happy with this, don't you think?
Yeah, he's got a 49% approval rate versus 30% disapproval in the poll, and it's a very good number for him, especially when you consider that all the other politicians they talk about aren't doing so well.
Interesting that the governor seems to be keeping a very low profile in his first year in office, and could that be part of it? Or is he just right on the issues to half of voters?
I think his profile, basically when you've heard about Governor Cooper as much as possible, that it's been job announcements, it's been the times he's filed lawsuits against the General Assembly, and the General Assembly as a body is not very popular, and so that's probably not hurting him. And also he has gained some news for being named to President Trump's opioid task force, and so that's given him some additional media coverage, and so I mean all those sorts of things have worked in his favor, and the fact that the state economy is doing well, and that all those sorts of things, the governor gets more credit than he should probably when things go well, and more blame when they don't. So he's sort of riding that wave as well.
That's an interesting transition to the data coming out of the Elon poll on President Donald Trump,
right?
Because he's faring a little bit better than he did previously, but a lot of people disapprove of the president.
Yeah, the number. Numbers are really pretty surprising, considering that he did win the state in the electoral college vote, the presidential vote. But he's underwater by 20 points: 37% approval, 57% disapproval. He was only at 34% the last time they asked people in early October, but those are not good numbers. And especially when you consider that Governor Cooper has 12 points higher approval rating than the president, then that should be some signs of concern for Republicans in the state.
And in fact, there are Republicans who are concerned about that. One of the things I know we'll be watching in 2018 is whether or not the president makes any appearance in North Carolina. And that'll be the indicator, wouldn't you think, of how people are feeling, how he cuts, so to speak,
right,
at the ballot box.
That'll make a difference. It sure will.
Interesting questions out of the Elon poll about the president. Tell us about the question they asked regarding the FBI director, Robert Mueller, and that possible Russian interference in the election.
Well, it was interesting in that about more than half of the people surveyed, and this was 771 North Carolina registered voters. The breakdown, because I've been asked about that, the breakdown is pretty much along party lines. So it's 40% Democrat, 30% Republican, 30% unaffiliated. So it's very much along the lines of the state party registration. But 52% of the people who were surveyed said they thought that this was a serious matter, that the Russian investigation is something that that should be done, and that it may bring up some serious issues about the president. Only 39% said it was just a political move, that this was just something anti-Trump move by politicians in Washington to try to discredit the president.
Now, among the Trump supporters, when they were asked about this question, they had some pretty intense feelings about that.
This was a big something that I pointed out in the story. There were big partisan divides on many issues, and this is one of them. roughly from both sides, but roughly 8 in 10 Republicans thought that this was politics and roughly 8 in 10 Democrats thought it was serious. So that's the way it broke down.
The Trump whole phenomenon in his presidency has been fascinating to watch in terms of media coverage. And, of course, you're editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, so this is your business, your industry of journalism. And we've got a lot of people, Rick, who seem to believe that the media coverage is biased against
the
president.
That's an interesting point, is that the president is not popular, but people think that the media is not giving him a fair shake. So 52% in this poll said that they thought the media was giving biased coverage or coverage that was too tough against the president. 44% said the coverage was not biased.
That's interesting, because that's higher really than his slice of the electorate that considers it themselves really ardent Trump supporters.
Of course, the media is not popular anyway. That may have something to do with it. And, you know, I mean, it's just like, you know, the Republicans continue winning the statewide vote for the legislature. If you count all the votes, Republicans typically get between 52 and 55% of the vote, but yet the Republican-dominated General Assembly's approval rating is about 30. So, I mean, just go figure that the institution itself isn't very popular. It's like the president himself may not be very, very popular, but the media is really unpopular, and so it doesn't always seem to add up.
I kind of wonder, Rick, if folks, at least some folks, seem to view the media these days as part of the political process versus, you know, the watchdog, the way that I was taught in college.
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think the fact that so many people get media from sources that tend to confirm their perspectives. And so people on the center right tend to watch, let's say, Fox News. They may be more likely to read publications like Breitbart and the like. And the folks on the center left gravitate toward MSNBC, let's say, or they may some would say CNN and the like. And so people, you know, do tend to segregate where they get their media and where they get their information. And so because of that, there's an awful lot of what they call confirmation bias in that process. And so, yeah, it does tend to make people think the media is part of the political process.
Now, the pollsters at Elon also asked a question about a very significant foreign policy issue. We all know that North Korea is rattling the sabers, so to speak. What do North Carolinians think about this possibility of some sort of conflict with North Korea?
They were asked, do you think that we'll actually have some sort of active nuclear weapons used by either the United States or North Korea within the next year? And roughly 1 in 4, 24% said yes. 62% said no out of that.
So we have to hope that the 24% are wrong.
That's correct. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. But another thing that breaks down there, too, is that baby boomers were the most likely to think that nuclear weapons would be used. And those who disapprove of President Trump are more likely to believe that nuclear weapons would be used than those who approve of him. So his fans tend to think that he's not going to be trigger happy, and his opponents think that he may be.
Interesting. You know, the question on the boomers and their view of the possibility, is that because perhaps that boomers lived through the Soviet Union?
That may be. The fact that we lived at the, you know, on the brink of nuclear disaster for a better part of 30-some years, nearly 40 years, and so that those memories haven't gone away completely.
Fascinating numbers. Now, the poll also took a look at the view of North Carolina's two U.S. senators. That would be Richard Burr and Tom Tillis. How are they doing?
Not very well. Once again, Senator Richard Burr got a 31% approval rating, 40% disapproval, 27% had no opinion. And then for Tillis, it was 28% approval, 41% disapproval, and 30% with no opinion whatsoever.
You know, it's fascinating that we have always seen the phenomenon with Senator Burr, that a big chunk of North Carolinians really don't have much knowledge of him whatsoever, even though he is a veteran politician. Makes you kind of wonder if Senator Tillis is going to be suffering from that same situation.
Yeah, and I think generally speaking, North Carolina voters have not had real favorable ratings or favorable feelings about their senators for a number of years, because we had the same sort of situation show up with Kay Hagan toward the end of her term, and certainly with Elizabeth Dole. North Carolinians, for some reason, they like people and they don't like them very much.
Well, it's fascinating data. It is coming from the latest Elon University poll. All of the information we've been talking about, you can read more about at carolinajournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The economy is always changing, but some elements of the economy remain remarkably constant despite all of the surrounding change. And our next guest has written a book highlighting one notable example. The book is titled Stateless Commerce, The Diamond Network and the Persistence of Relational Exchange. The author is Barack Richmond, Edgar P. and Elizabeth C. Bartlett Professor of Law and Business Administration at Duke University. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're talking, as the subtitle of the book it tells us, about the Diamond Network. Before we get into what's interesting about this from your perspective, tell people who don't know, how does this Diamond Network work in ways they might not have realized?
Well, any visitor to 47th Street in New York would instantly see a scene that is very different from the rest of New York. So we see an organizational structure, a distribution chain that at its face is remarkably different from what we have come to associate with modern commerce. And what we are seeing on 47th Street is a network of intermediaries. So diamonds, of course, are mined from the ground. We have large companies, most notably De Beers, that then takes these diamonds from the ground and distributes them to this network of intermediaries. And what we're seeing on 47th Street are the intermediaries that take the rough stones, sort them, polish them, sort them again, polish them, and then ultimately sell them to the people who make diamond jewelry. And this network of intermediaries is – these are not the wholesalers that sell things to Walmart. These are not the utilizers of modern technology, of modern commerce. What we see here are family businesses, individuals who have been in the industry for a long time, have their ancestors have been in the industry for a long time, and they trade diamonds. They trade diamonds much like in most pre-modern societies, people were trading grapefruits.
And if we look at this business compared to others, this is substantially different from what happens in much of the rest of the economy, isn't it?
So it's different. It is substantially different in a number of different ways. And again, the best way to illustrate how different it is simply by looking at it. It looks different. You see a chaos of a bizarre economy, bizarre with two A's. You see the predominance of ethnic networks. Individuals walking along 47th Street are the people who dominate this segment of the industry. They are Orthodox Jews. They are Palanpuri Jains. That's an ethnic minority in India. These are Central Asian networks. These are Bukharan and Lebanese networks. And they're the ones who buy and sell diamonds, polish the diamonds, and navigate the global network.
We are chatting with Duke Professor Barack Richmond. Now, many of us may see this if we go to 47th Street and say, huh, that's kind of interesting. You, as a professor, take a look at it and say, wait a minute, there's more to this story. Tell us why this was something worthy of describing in this book called Stateless Commerce.
Exactly. So the title, Stateless Commerce, is derived from the notion that whenever there is a transaction, there needs to be some sense of governance. And it's just breaking it down. If somebody buys something on credit, and credit sales are economically desirable no matter what industry you are and no matter what time period you're in. But if someone is going to give you a product and expect you to pay down the road, there has to be some source of assurance, some source of governance to make sure that that transaction goes through. In the diamond industry, that is an especially acute challenge because we're talking about diamonds. You give me $1 million worth of diamonds today. What assurance do you have them that I'm going to pay you in 30 days? I have the diamonds with me. They are portable. They're universally valuable. They're virtually untraceable. I can go anywhere. In modern commerce, if you're selling me big stuff, a ton of steel or a house, we have liens. We have legal instruments that help us secure the transaction, sources of collateral. If I don't pay, then you have other sources to get me, and that in turn forces me to pay. But in the diamond industry, the law fails. Our legal institution simply is incapable of securing these transactions. So I approach this problem asking that basic question. How can these extraordinarily hazardous transactions be governed? How is it economically feasible? How does it comport with some kind of economic logic that credit can be extended? And that the answer to that question is also the answer to the question, why does this industry look so different? You have families dominating the industry. You have ethnic networks dominating the industry. And those kinship ties, family and community ties, serve as the source of collateral. If I don't pay you back, it means that my family, not just myself, my family is out of the business. It also means that my I have brought shame on my community, so to speak. And my community will no longer accept me as it did before.
And is this the relational exchange that's part of your title?
That is the relational exchange, exactly. We have this certain notion of economic history, of economic modernization, that before there were legal institutions, we only had personal exchange. And it was an extraordinary accomplishment, extraordinary economic accomplishment to go from personal exchange to impersonal exchange. When impersonal exchange is possible, you can trade with anybody. You open up markets. You're no longer beholden to sources of power, concentrated authority. You bring in dynamism. You bring in innovators. You open up scale. But impersonal exchange requires some kind of non-traditional governance mechanism. And most people think that the emergence of courts enabled impersonal exchange and really expanded the ability of, in particular, European economies to grow along the Middle Ages. What this paper suggests is that impersonal exchange is not always possible with certain industries, and certainly the role of courts and the state is not always effective or even available in supporting economic expansion and market transactions. And that's why we see these pockets of of relational exchange that persist into the modern era.
Are there some lessons to be learned that we can apply to other sectors of the economy?
So there are lots of lessons. One is that there is a reason that different areas of commerce, different industries are organized in their own way. Every particular transaction in every industry has its own features, has its own nuances that it has to overcome and manage. And to achieve efficiencies in those different kinds of economic settings is different. So what is good for the banking is not good for diamond, which is not good for steel, which is not good for cars. And we should not apply any kind of hegemonic view of what efficiency looks like or what we think efficiency should look like. Certainly, one great lesson is we have to think about the legal and social environment that can nurture different industries in ways that we're not entirely familiar with. And also, we should understand that that certain economic policy tools should be applied with care, that often the legal and social and structural environment of different areas of commerce, of different industries are not understood at first glance, and we might be hesitant to apply certain policy interventions.
If you'd like to learn more, you can read the book. It's titled Stateless Commerce, The Diamond Network and the Persistence of Relational Exchange. Its author and our guest, Barak Richmond, professor at Duke University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's rare to hear an elected Democrat in North Carolina describe public schools as failing, but State Representative Billy Richardson recently used that word. Richardson was debating a bill on state budget technical corrections. He wanted to address a larger issue.
Why are we sitting there worrying about principal pay, you know, adjusting little technical changes in principal pay and teachers when our schools are failing? I mean, our school system is failing at an alarming rate, and we could fix it if we had the will. Why aren't we doing a special session on how we can get out of the 40s and into the top five in schools? Our number one charge as a Constitution is to take care of schools. Why aren't we having a special session on fixing failing schools? Folks, let's don't do this bill. This is not good law. It is not the right thing to do.
Richardson's words did not go unanswered. Republican Nelson Dollar is the State House's chief budget writer. He responded directly to Richardson's criticism.
There have been some issues raised and just raised again by the gentleman about having some special session for addressing educational reform. And if I might opine on that for just a couple of moments, and just to simply say this, we, for the last several years, have had sessions, long sessions and regular sessions and short sessions of this General Assembly dealing with a whole range of educational reforms. We have invested billions of new dollars over the last 6-7 years in education. We've reformed K through 3 in particular in terms of what we're doing in the classroom. Think programs like Read to Achieve, our early childhood education programs, the investments that we've made, and look at the grades that are coming back in terms of student performance, increases in student performance, increases in teacher pay. Once again, this year, just about a month ago, the DPI came out, not us, but DPI came out and said we had once again hit a record high school graduation rate in the state of North Carolina. So we have been working on education, and if there's any doubt in some members' mind of that, I'd be more than happy to sit down with you and get some other folks to sit down with you and explain to you what we've been doing the last several years and the positive impacts it's had.
That's Republican State Representative Nelson Dollar. He's the chief state House budget writer. He's responding to Democratic Representative Billy Richardson. Richardson described North Carolina's public schools as failing. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors, the recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. There's a new leader for a North Carolina group that focuses on the state's business environment and the free market. The group is the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. Its new executive director, Jonathan Kapler. He joins us now at Carolina Journal Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jonathan, first of all, I gave way too short of an explanation of what the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation is. Tell us about the group.
Sure, really. The mission is actually really kind of has two main focuses to its mission statement. One is really providing nonpartisan political analysis and research for the state's business community, really in an objective way, and then also providing educational programming both to the business community and the public at large around making the state more business-friendly and having a business an environment in which the state can prosper in the business market. So our wheelhouse and what we spend a lot of our time is elections, campaign finance, polling, demographic analysis, so that the business community can engage in a way in which it wants to in its civic responsibility.
You are new as executive director, but not new to the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. Tell us what you did in a past life for this group.
Sure. I'm so excited to rejoin the Free Enterprise Foundation. Between 2009 and 2013, I was the research director at the organization, and so very familiar with the programming of the organization. And now I'm rejoining as executive director. Certainly have a broader scope of responsibilities, but very excited to be back amongst my friends and kind of coming back home with the organization. And doing a lot of the stuff that I love.
Between those two times, you stepped out and were actually in the world of higher education / government working for the University of North Carolina. How is that experience going to impact what you're doing now?
Certainly. Well, I worked for the UNC system, and so I was one of two people that represented largely in Raleigh and for a time in Washington, D.C. as well, all 17 institutions in the UNC system. And so that was actually great because it allowed me to kind of better understand the state as a whole, travel the state quite a bit, and really understand things at a more grassroots level and kind of get more engaged in the communities that are around the state. And so the UNC system has 17 wonderful institutions that are in every corner of the state. And so I really valued my time there, developed some wonderful relationships, got to work with both Presidents Ross and Spellings, learned a lot from both of them. And so really appreciate the leadership lessons I learned there along the way.
Do you suspect that there are going to be opportunities for increased tie-ins between what North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation is doing and what university researchers or entities are up to?
Absolutely. And I certainly want to be able to tap into both the network of very talented faculty members and students, right, to leverage the work of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation and, frankly, give folks an opportunity to take some of their expertise and talents and use it for a statewide nonprofit like this.
We are chatting with Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. Near the top of this interview, you mentioned that there are two main pillars of what the group does. Let's talk about both of those and what you see lying ahead. So one of them is, I guess, the part that you spent a lot of time on when you were research director, right? That is what's going on with elections, electoral trends, which districts favor which party. What do you see happening on that front moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, North Carolina is among the most politically dynamic states in the country. And so our organization is so perfectly positioned to be really in the thick of dynamics that are in the news every day. So we do a lot of candidate briefings, elections briefings, candidate forums. We publish the Almanac of North Carolina Politics, which provides an overview of elections and districts in every corner of the state, mainly at the state legislative level. And we're providing that programming for the state's business community, but also for the public at large. And so if you have an interest or questions about candidates, where they stand on issues, those kinds of things, particularly on business related issues, we're the place to go as a resource for you on those things. So information largely lives online these days, and certainly leveraging social media and other things as well.
Why is it important for people within North Carolina's business community to have this type of information? Some people might think, well, you know, they should be just busy with doing their business. Why do they need to know so much about what's going on in the political world?
Right, absolutely. Well, the decisions that our elected leaders are making impact us in a variety of different ways. And, you know, the business leaders of the state are the ones providing jobs and spurring the economy forward. And so it's really important that they understand how to engage in the process and that they have the information to effectively engage in the legislative and political process so that legislators have the best information available and that we have legislators that understand the value of the North Carolina business community.
So that's one big piece of what you do. The name North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation also suggests that there is this focus on the free enterprise system and letting people know about it. What do you see happening on that piece of the foundation?
Sure, yeah, and we actually kind of blend those two things in a variety of different ways. And so, for example, soon we'll be releasing our business ratings of the North Carolina General Assembly, which has a kind of an analysis of how legislators approach business issues through their time in the legislative long session. And so that's helpful for both legislators. It's helpful for the business community in the state. It's helpful for the public at large to kind of understand how those two, the intersection of kind of legislative politics and the business issues kind of meet. We also do other kind of programming. We bring in scholars, have other events that are kind of focused around issues that are of interest to the business community. And we're looking for new and innovative ways, right? There are other opportunities, TV, radio, and those kinds of things to provide some programming so that the business community has a voice in North Carolina.
So the name of the group is the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. A lot of people associate free enterprise and business with Republicans. You're speaking on a libertarian talk show that is often seen as being conservative. Is there really a conservative, liberal, libertarian bent to the Free Enterprise Foundation, or are you sort of working with everyone?
Right. Our main goal is to provide objective analysis so that individuals, however they choose to engage, can do so in a way that's informed and educated. So we do not lobby. We don't take positions specifically on issues. The information that we're providing is information that we hope is viewed as objective and credible for anyone to use. The business community in North Carolina is not monolithic. They don't always think the same things. And so our role is certainly not to pick winners and losers on particular issues like that. It's simply to provide that information for the business community to do with what they can.
As you've been talking to business leaders, have they given you some ideas of things they want the Free Enterprise Foundation to do that it either has not done as much of or done in a different way?
Absolutely. There's lots of ideas out there. It's always just a choice of time and resources, right? We're a small organization, but we're fortunate in North Carolina to have so many other organizations that we can partner with on various things where there's overlapping interest. So we're in the process of exploring a lot of those new things, and I'm excited to begin my tenure to be able to kind of implement some of those new things.
You mentioned a little bit earlier that much of this information lives online these days, and that's the best way for people to find out about these things. So if people want to know what the Free Enterprise Foundation is up to, where should they go?
Absolutely. Our website, the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, it's ncfef.org, pretty easy. And we're definitely in the process as we enter into an election cycle where it's going to be a lot of content. And our value is providing some background context so that you don't get overwhelmed by the information. You understand really what's important.
And so people don't get overwhelmed by the website. What are some of the main things they'll see when they go there?
Certainly. We're trying to roll out some additional kind of snackable content, some, you know, bite-sized chunks so that you have some sense about what's happening. And certainly as quick-moving as our news cycles are these days, it's important to kind of stay up with it on a more regular basis. And so we're looking to shift in that way as well. But we also have longer-term research projects as well, campaign finance analysis and those kinds of things that are a little bit more meaty substance as well.
Well, as people get ready for another election season to crank up, one resource they're going to want to check out is that website, ncfef.org. We've been speaking with Jonathan Kapler. He is the new executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Governor Roy Cooper is one of just three U.S. governors that serves on the Trump administration's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. Now, the president believes that the situation is so serious that he's declared the opioid abuse problem a health emergency in our country. Our next guest believes that policymakers have failed to properly diagnose the opioid crisis and thus the proper course to address it. Dr. Jeffrey Singer is a surgeon in Phoenix. He's also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's written a very interesting piece about this issue. Dr. Singer, welcome to Carolina Journal Radio.
Well, thank you. Happy to be here.
So Governor Cooper is one of those governors on the commission, and it looks like the commission is going to be looking at several different things, identifying some federal funding, addressing treatment issues, prescription practices, and things like that. Do you believe that the Trump administration commission is on the wrong track with this?
I think they're on the wrong track because the emphasis has been on basically restricting opioids as opposed to restricting overdoses. I think we need to shift our focus. The goal should be that we want to have less people overdosing. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was made clear that doctors were under-prescribing for pain and people were not getting enough control of their pain. And then an effort was made to encourage doctors to prescribe more opioids for pain and patients to accept it because patients were afraid as well. Now what's happened is the pendulum has swung the other way. So we've gone from encouraging people to use opioids for pain and encouraging doctors to prescribe it to now discouraging it. But if you look at the numbers, discouraging the prescription of opioids for pain is going after the wrong problem. Prescriptions now, according to the CDC, have come down. Prescription rates have come down 7 straight years. In fact, the prescriptions of higher dose, more potent opioids are down 41% from what they were in 2010, according to the CDC. Every state now has instituted these prescription drug monitoring programs, which monitor doctors and patients, and have had the effect of basically casting a chilling effect on doctors prescribing opioids. So that's another thing that's made opioids come down. The Drug Enforcement Administration has ordered manufacturers to decrease the production of opioids 25% in 2016, and this year they ordered another 20% reduction. But look what's happening. In response to all of this, the overdose rate is going up, 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 and it was 35,000 opioid overdose deaths, I'm sorry, 33,000 in 2015. And according to the projections, at the end of this year, they're going to tell us the 2016 numbers, and it looks like it's going to go up even more. But if you look at those numbers, the majority now are from fentanyl and heroin. And actually, prescription opioids, as the cause of the overdose deaths, have stabilized or receded. So all of they're mistaken in thinking that the cause of the overdose crisis is doctors prescribing medications for their patients in pain.
And what is the problem then, Dr. Singer?
Well, it's multifactorial. Why we have to ask ourselves, why are people seeking to abuse drugs in the, you know, in the illegal market? And there's a lot of different factors. There's social factors, there are economic factors. I mean, there are certain regions of the country where it seems to be hardest hit by the opioid overdose crisis. And in many areas, these are people where there's chronic unemployment, where there's broken families. So there's a lot of different reasons why people are turning to drugs to alter their mind. Now, granted, it's true, there were some bad apple doctors out there who I wouldn't even call them doctors. I would call them people who happen to have an MD degree and are using it to become pill pushers. And for the most part, they've been, you know, rounded up and arrested and punished, and that's as it should be. But the overwhelming majority of doctors are treating people in pain. There's this false narrative out there that if you take opioids, you become an addict. But there's a tendency for people to link use the words addict and chemical dependency interchangeably, and they're not. Addiction is actually a separate behavioral disease where you crave it even when you've been detoxed and where you'll do self-destructive behavior in order to get the drug. And study after study, including from the government's own numbers, show there's a roughly 1 to 2% rate of actual addiction in people receiving opioids chronically for pain from their doctors. And the government data shows that less than 25% of people who show up in emergency rooms with overdoses even obtained a prescription from a doctor in the preceding year.
Well, Dr. Singer, if from a public policy perspective, if the Trump administration is off the mark in terms of focusing so much on overprescribing and the situation with doctors, what would be the appropriate policy prescription?
Well, first of all, the reason people are overdosing is because they're seeking these drugs in the black market. When you have prohibition, you never know, of course, what you're getting. Right? Because we don't have alcohol prohibition anymore, when I go to the supermarket to buy a bottle of liquor, it never crosses my mind that the strength of the alcohol on that bottle is not what it says on the label, or that it may be tainted with something else that I don't want, because it's legal. So we have a legal market with, you know, legal recourses. So the reason people are dying is because they're buying what they think is, let's say, oxycodone on the illegal market, and it turns out it's laced with fentanyl, and that's what they're dying from. And the data is showing everybody's being basically driven to the fentanyl and heroin. So the real answer, obviously, is to look at ending prohibition. But that's probably politically not a realistic option at this point in our nation's history. So then let's focus on stopping people from dying instead of stopping people who have pain from getting relief. So harm reduction measures, which are part of the commission's recommendations, that's what the emphasis should be on, in my opinion. So, for example, what kind of harm reduction measures? Well, medication-assisted treatment has been shown to be helpful, both methadone maintenance clinics and other kind of treatment like Suboxone. But it's very, very difficult. There's a lot of bureaucracy in the attempts to set up methadone maintenance clinics. And while there's been some loosening up of the regulations, it's very hard for doctors to become certified to treat as an outpatient drug addicts using Suboxone. And not only that, but any physician extender like a PA or a nurse practitioner has to get all sorts of special waivers to do it. So we need to liberalize those regulations to make it easier for doctors and doctor extenders to do medication-assisted treatment. We need to make naloxone, the antidote to an overdose, more readily available. Right now, most states have made it where you can get it directly from a pharmacist, but because it's a prescription drug and not an over-the-counter drug, you still have to go to a pharmacist, and the pharmacist can prescribe it to you. Well, that deters some people who are afraid that by giving their information to a pharmacist, they may get into trouble because they got a substance abuse problem. That deters some people from getting it. So since it's such a safe drug, if the FDA would make naloxone over-the-counter, then people could go buy it over-the-counter and check out at the cash register, and they can keep their private life more secret. In addition, states, 40 states so far, but all of them should adopt what they call Good Samaritan laws, because if you are a witness to an overdose, you're afraid to call the police or other first responders to save the life of the person who's overdosing because you're afraid you'll get arrested.
We've been talking with Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He is a surgeon. He is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Dr. Singer, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.